This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Next up, we have a pretty interesting but rather unsettling article from the Malaysian Insight, which suggests that supporters of the Islamic State, or IS, have actually set their sights on Southeast Asia becoming the next terrorism hotspot. And this is coming, of course, after they're now just kind of a shadow of their former selves in the Middle East.
And the ASEAN region might seem tempting for a number of reasons. Porous borders, the existence of logistical bases, weak regimes, poor enforcement measures, and disenchantment from among marginalized Muslims. There have been brief outbursts of IS-linked violence in Southeast Asia, notably in southern Philippines.
And just for some numbers, in 2017, militant and insurgent groups championing separatist causes, which later forged alliances or became affiliated with IS, committed 348 terror acts, which resulted in 292 deaths. And these groups came from countries including Bangladesh, Indonesia, here in Malaysia, Myanmar, the Philippines, and Thailand. And this article also points out that it used to be that if you wanted to, you know, kind of be a part of IS, you had to go through training, you had to swear oaths, different things. And now instead, it is simpler, sadly. You know, it's more a question of committing the act and then saying this was done in the name of.
Right, and part of this is also coming from the rise of exclusivist sentiments. According to research fellow Muhammad Faisal Abdul Rahman from the ARSIS Center of Excellence for National Security, he described it as the pathway towards terrorism, saying a person goes through the cognitive process of exclusivism before he is further radicalized into a terrorist. Exclusivism conditions an individual's mind and values into believing that others are less human, less moral, and deserves to be harmed.
Which actually chimes in with survey results that emerged late last year by the Merdeka Center, which found a growing trend in support and tolerance for terrorist activities, despite also finding, conversely, that Muslims in Malaysia report very, very low tendencies for direct participation in violence.
So participation or tolerance here tends to take the form of supporting extremism or justifying violence in the name of Islam. According to the study, support for the Islamic State was also the highest in Malaysia. So we wanted to later understand more about the mindset, this mindset that is purported in these studies.
So we're going to be speaking with Ahmad Farouk Musa, the chairman and director of the Islamic Renaissance Front, in just a little bit. Stay tuned for that. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Because freedom matters. BFM 89.9.
It's the Evening Edition with Lynn and Kelvin. We are looking at a story that suggests that Southeast Asia might actually be the next hotspot for IS-related acts of terrorism. And a study that kind of suggests that there is a growing sense of support and tolerance for terrorist activities in the sense of, look, if it's in the name of, you know, a certain religion, that is, you know, that is something that I can get behind. So we're trying to understand the mindset of people who might fall into this category. And we're crossing over now to Ahmad Farouk Musa, the chairman and director of the Islamic Renaissance Front. Farouk, thanks for joining us on the program. Do these survey results come as a surprise to you?
Actually, I've been basically studying on this particular issue, and we have been like having a few meetings, conferences and seminars in this country and abroad, especially in the Asian region, in Thailand and Indonesia as well. And actually, this is something that has been presented before everywhere in this ASEAN region. And I think that we can expect this kind of results. Like the actual act of extremism was actually low, is, you know, like, but the sentiments towards those who are oppressed or towards defending the name of Islam is strong, is basically high in among Muslims in this country. So those are two things that we have to differentiate. One is the actual act of extremism, and the other one is just a sentiment or what you feel about something that is close to your heart.
And in Malaysia, do those sentiments translate to anything, especially in terms of providing financing or recruitment for terrorist groups?
So I believe that many of them, that they had this kind of feelings that they have to do something to support the Muslims who are being oppressed everywhere in the world. And I think that the least they could do would, apart from their dua for this, the safety of the jihadists everywhere in the world, is basically to chip a little bit of money, whatever they could afford, to support this global jihad. And I think that that's the least that they could do by doing that. And of course, if they could do more by basically trying to advocate for other friends or relatives to support this cause. And of course, it's not in the in what you would say as recruitment of people for the global jihadists, but at least they could help and assist to alleviate the sufferings of the Muslims everywhere in the world.
So how would people in this group then reconcile the violence that comes with giving support? How is the violence justified?
I think because it's in the tenet of the religion itself. Many people believe that it's an eye for an eye. So they believe that, you know, like if a Muslim is being killed, then he has the right to kill others as well. So, like, you know, they were being bombed, thousands of them died. And what they could do is to retaliate against this kind of injustices. You see, the idea of war in Islam to many people is first as a self-defense. And it's not only defending your right and your dignity, but also when you're being assaulted, to assault back. I think it is like, a kind of retaliation. You know, if you're being killed, then you should go out and defend yourself and kill your enemies as well.
Would the same people who believe in violence as a form of justice also agree on the belief that Islam is a religion of peace?
Yeah, that's a very controversial thing. You know, like people everywhere is saying that Islam is a religion of peace. And the word Islam is basically peace, means peace. So, I mean, how could you then say that, you know, it's a religion of peace when in actual fact it's advocating violence as well? So, like, you know, this is a very controversial issue. And I think that, you know, to understand this is to understand the fiqh or the jurisprudence of jihad, the fiqh of jihad, we call it. And this is a very, very interesting topic. And I do not think that I could go into depth in a few minutes interview on this particular issue. But suffice to say is that what is known as jihad, in the actual sense, is yes, it is self-defense. But defending yourself doesn't mean that you should not kill your opponents. So, you know, you can take an aggressive part in defending yourself as well.
Dr. Farooq, there are a lot of troubling things about this survey, obviously, but one of it that really stuck out to me was that it showed that support for extremism is creeping into our schools as well as our education system. Can you tell us how this is happening?
Well, to be honest with you, I do not think that anywhere in the school or UC curriculum that would advocate this kind of understanding. And I believe that, you know, if you look at the people who indulge themselves in these jihadi movements, many of them, they are not from religious background. In fact, like I've read so many reports saying that most jihadis are engineers. They are engineers. So basically because to them, basically, they look black and white, and not the grey in between. So that's a real problem.
What is it about the indoctrination that appeals to those who might see the world in black and white?
If you are being indoctrinated, if you are basically like the Taliban, when they had this very rudimentary understanding of Islam, and of course some of the Wahhabis, for example, who has this very kind of virulent ideology that is known as, what is known in Arabic as allegiance and disavowal, to say that, you know, you have to pledge your allegiance to the Muslims and you have to consider anything non-Muslims as your enemies. or anyone non-Muslims as your enemies. So, you know, this particular doctrine is very virulent. And because of that, we have seen that even lately, during when I was growing up, I have not heard of anyone saying that you cannot wish Merry Christmas to anyone else, to your Christian friends. But nowadays, you know, you have heard that every year people will say, okay, when it comes to Christmas, you cannot wish Christmas to your Christian friends. So this type of ideology has been growing over the years, and it's because of this Wahhabi tendencies of this kind of doctrine of allegiance and disavowal.
The survey also showed that multi-faith education awareness programs were not something that would interest this group. What then would make more of an impact?
Yeah, the issue is that we can talk about multi-faith understanding and stuff, but still, to me, what is more important than learning about other faith would be to interact with people of other faith. You know, if you know someone who are non-Muslims, even among the Sunni Muslims, if they know someone who are Shiites, for example, right, who are close to them, then they would have a different kind of perceptions toward the others. And I think that more importantly in our society is to have an education system where people can interact, where students can interact between whether you're Muslims, you're Christians, you're Taoists, you're Buddhists, you're Hindus, you're Sikhs, so they can interact and they can understand each other better than just reading through lectures or through books and attending courses and multi-faith conferences and stuff. And I think more importantly is the practical aspect of it, that is to be able to interact between each other.
Farooq, thank you so much for sharing those insights. That was Ahmad Farooq Musa, the chairman and director of the Islamic Renaissance Front. And this is actually a topic that we've explored before on the show and on the station, to get a personal and intimate account of how a Malay Muslim was recruited and radicalized. You can look up the podcast, The Road to Radicalization. You can also send in your thoughts. Let us know. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. In the meantime, we still have a couple of messages that have come through about Syed Siddiq and endorsement and whether ministers should be involved in doing it at all. Puvin says it's wrong on so many levels. The story just doesn't add up. It also sets precedents and a wrong impression. Politics and business should never mix.
Yeah, well, I can agree with that, but I still think that this isn't necessarily like a jive between big companies and a government. This is more like smallish entrepreneurs with one person.
Yes, but we're also getting a lot of tweets and I think a lot of information about how this isn't necessarily a smallish business with a downtrodden entrepreneur. That's not the true story here. You know, we are talking about somebody who has his own ways and means to kind of get into the spaces that he wants. And for me, it's more about if you just don't do it, then we can set a precedent that this is not something that is an acceptable way of doing business. You shouldn't be pitching a fit that somebody that you sent a bunch of free products over and then you didn't get the exposure you wanted. And as a politician, why put yourself in that situation? That's what troubles me. You know, that there's no point. There's no winning here except by people who think, no, the intentions are good.
This is just at me.
I mean, yes, but I just think intentions don't mean a whole lot if you're just going to get in trouble and it's such a sticky situation to begin with. Keep those thoughts coming. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us also at BFM Radio. We're headed to some music and then the news. And then after that, we're going to be talking about, Cambridge, the University of Cambridge versus Cambridge International University. To find out more, keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.